Welcome to Capital Conversations by the Venture Asset Management Initiative produced by IMD, your go-to podcast to understanding the dynamics in venture capital. In this new episode, we explore alternative exit options for VC funds with Liz Campbell, CIO at Portfolio Advisors. Founded in 1994, Portfolio Advisors is an experienced private markets manager with dedicated primary, secondary, co-investment, real estate, and direct credit teams. In 2023, Portfolio Advisors combined with FS Investments, a pioneer in the democratization of alternative assets. Together, they manage over $82 billion in assets for both institutional and wealth management clients around the world. Liz Campbell, as a member of Portfolio Advisors Management Committee, shares oversight of firm strategy and, as CIO, oversees the firm's investment activities across private equity, including venture capital, private credit, and private real estate. In this episode, Liz focuses specifically on the complex and evolving landscape of venture capital liquidity options, offering a deep dive into the current challenges, innovative exit strategies, and the shifting dynamics of how investors can realize returns in an increasingly sophisticated market.
So yeah, there are two kind of traditional forms of liquidity within the VC market that we all think of. You know, the first is an IPO going public. The second is traditional M&A, mergers and acquisitions, so getting acquired by another private equity firm or by a strategic acquirer. But there are a lot of other liquidity options for venture capital. The secondary market is becoming increasingly popular, particularly in today's environment where liquidity is fairly scarce. I think venture capitalists have done a nice job being creative and developing alternative exit routes. The secondary market is essentially a non-stock exchange marketplace where investors can buy and sell shares in private companies. And then there's a less popular one, which is just a buyback of a company. That's typically a company will repurchase shares of its own stock from investors. You don't see that particularly often. That generally happens when, you know, a company is very bullish on its prospects and they want to control more of the company itself. An IPO, I'm happy to give a couple examples of those. IPOs are what you hear about most often in the news. They tend to be very large, big exits. If they're good IPOs, they tend to generate the best returns for venture capitalists. And so while rare, that's kind of the golden ticket for venture capitalists if they can pull it off. But not every company is well positioned for an IPO or has the opportunity to go public. You know, typically the right companies to consider an IPO are ones with the potential to become a leading market player, a category killer in their respective markets, companies that have more stable cash flows or stable growth prospects. As we all know, the public markets can be quite volatile. And if a company is not generating positive cash flow or isn't close to generating it and has a lot of volatility in its revenue streams, that can impact the stock price adversely. So overall, I would say company maturity and the ability to be a market leading player are kind of the two most important considerations. You know, M&A is a great exit method. It's generally the most common exit method within VCs. M&A has a lot of benefits, and some VCs frankly prefer that to the public markets. One, there's greater certainty of liquidity. So you don't have to wait to sell your shares in the public market. Typically, a price is agreed on, and that's what you get paid out when the transaction closes. There's greater control, so the selling company can negotiate specific terms with the buyer regarding the future of the business. So employee retention is often important, the product roadmap, things like that. And then you don't have to deal with the market uncertainty overall. If market conditions are volatile like they are today, an M&A can offer a more predictable exit environment compared to the public markets. And then we hear about this more and more today, but the regulatory burden of going public is pretty extensive. And so many, many companies prefer to avoid that, or many VCs prefer to avoid that. Couple examples, recent examples. People often say IPOs are the best way to generate an outsized return, but M&A can do the same thing. There was not super recent, but it's a good example of WhatsApp. I think we all know WhatsApp. It's regularly used by most of us. Sequoia Capital, which is, you know, a top tier VC, invested
I think it was $8 million in the company in 2011 and another $52 million in 2013 for $60 million total. When they first invested, WhatsApp had essentially no revenue, but very fast growth. They got acquired by Facebook, you know, only 3 years later in 2014 for $22 billion, which generated over $3 billion of proceeds on that $60 million investment. So that was a great outcome and frankly, probably preferable to an IPO. But the IPO markets, particularly 2021, when valuations were at a peak, are a great way to maximize valuations as well. The thing that you have to be careful about is, as I mentioned earlier, the volatility that can ensue after a company goes public. So VCs are typically locked up for a period of time, typically 90 to 180 days. So they can't sell their shares in the market to protect the stock price. A company can go public for a really lofty valuation, and then that valuation can decline. And so you've got that uncertainty when you're locked up. I think probably the most famous example of that is Rivian, the car maker, the great company, done a great job in the electric vehicle market. But it went public in late 2021 when valuations in the public markets were at all-time highs. It's $78 a share. That valued the company at over $100 billion. By the end of the first day, I think it was up to $125 billion. And just 6 days after the IPO, it had traded up further to almost $180 a share, which is more than double the IPO price. It's the largest IPO of 2021, seventh largest in U.S. history. But the stock has since lost about 90% of its value. So that shows you the upside, but then there's also the downside. So VCs just have to weigh those factors when considering M&A versus public markets. It's definitely scarce today. It's as scarce as it's been in recent memory. Just to put some numbers around it, this year's VC exit value in the United States is on track to reach $98 billion. That might sound like a big number, but that's 86% of a decline from the 2021 peak levels. And it would be the lowest level since 2016. That obviously has led to a lack of distributions for investors in venture funds, what we call limited partners. And at the same time, although liquidity is down, venture capital investment levels have come down, but they're still pretty healthy. And these two things combined means that a metric that we look at closely, which is DPI, it's distributions over the amount of contributed capital, it's at an all-time low today. So there's a lot of demand from limited partners asking venture capitalists to get them some liquidity to return capital to them. There's a saying that DPI is the new IRR in venture capital, but it's led to some interesting trends within the market, some really interesting creativity that we've seen to generate that liquidity for investors. A lot of disruptors have emerged. I'll start with something that happened recently that was really interesting. VCs, as I mentioned, have gotten a lot more creative in trying to generate more liquidity for their investors. We recently saw a transaction in September. Sequoia bought over $850 million of Stripe shares. Stripe is the payment company, from its limited partners at a $70 billion valuation. Really, this is an example of a secondary deal, but a really interesting secondary deal, because the Sequoia Fund is not selling shares to an outside party, but it's using a subsequent fund to purchase the shares from investors and a previous fund. Obviously, it's an indication of Sequoia's conviction in the company, but also an indication of how much limited partners are hammering VCs for liquidity. That limited partners were in funds that were raised from 2009 to 2012. And so they had been in Stripe for coming up on 15 years. So I think that was a good outcome for both Sequoia, but also the limited partners. My expectation is that this could become a model for other VCs in the future who have really strongly performing, growing companies, but that have been invested in them for a long time and need to get liquidity back to their investors. And on that note, you know, secondary activity, I referred to it earlier, has not traditionally been as popular within venture capital as it has been within private equity or buyout strategies. But it has really picked up over the last few years as the IPO market activity has been muted. I think that trend will only continue. There's been a fair amount of capital raised by dedicated venture capital secondary funds. And I think just with volatility in the markets and the fact that venture capital tends to be the most illiquid alternative asset class, it's a good development. I think it's a healthy development for the market. Another form of a secondary transaction that we're starting to see more of are these continuation vehicles. People refer to them as CVs. They have been relatively common in private equity, less so in venture capital. These are basically secondary investment vehicles that allow general partners to effectively reset the clock for several years. They will sell old assets, sometimes a single asset, sometimes multiple assets, into a new vehicle, and they give their limited partners the option of selling 100% of their stake. They can roll 100% of their stake into the new vehicle, or they can choose a combination of that. So also, you know, you've got to be aware of potential conflicts of interest with those, but a good tool to give investors some optionality in generating liquidity.
In the periodic table of venture capital exits, traditional mergers and acquisitions and private equity acquisitions emerge as the noble gases. More consistent, reliable, stable, continuing to provide liquidity even when IPO markets are dormant, thanks to the cash reserves of strategic acquirers and private equity firms with substantial dry powder waiting to be deployed.
I will say, full disclosure, chemistry was not my best subject in high school, but I will try to do this justice. You know, I think this may be a boring answer, but I think I would go with traditional M&A. It is steady, you know, it'll ebb and flow, but not like the public markets. There is always M&A activity going on in the market today, despite the fact that there's limited liquidity overall in VC and the IPO window has been largely shut for the past 2 years. M&A continues to happen. Strategic acquirers still have plenty of cash on the books to go out and acquire other companies. And then I would also loop private equity acquisitions in. Private equity has been increasingly buying venture-backed companies. They've got a ton of dry powder, which is capital they've raised in their funds that needs to get deployed over the next kind of 3 to 5 years. And so that's another really stable source of capital that produces exits for venture capitalists. So, you know, in every market, you're going to see M&A and private equity firms buying venture-backed companies. So that tends to be the most stable source of exits for the market.
NAV loans represent a flexible yet controversial financing mechanism for venture capital funds, offering alternative liquidity by borrowing against a fund's net asset value, with general partners needing to carefully navigate potential LP concerns, transparency requirements, and the risk of diminishing overall fund returns.
So yeah, NAV loans are a relatively recent phenomenon in venture. They've been much more popular in buyouts, and that's for a few different reasons. NAV financing is essentially a credit facility that's secured against the net asset value or the market value of the holdings in a fund. The lender's usually a financial institution like a bank, or there have been some private funds raised to provide NAV loans, and then the borrower is the investment fund itself. These have become more popular, especially with interest rates increasing over the last couple of years, because you think about a traditional loan, they typically involve a rigid collateral and repayment structure, often resulting in liquidity constraints. On the other hand, NAV financing matches access to credit to the in and outflow of the underlying fund's cash flows overall in the portfolio. It generally results in a more flexible, efficient, cost-effective fundraising mechanism. And GPs are starting to use these. There are a few different ways they'll use them, but the two primary ways or reasons that they'll use them is just access to traditional capital. So obtaining additional liquidity beyond traditional sources for their portfolio companies, and then immediate, probably more controversial, but immediate liquidity for investors. So NAV facilities can be used to accelerate distributions to LPs. The reason why they're so attractive in today's market for general partners is that, you know, when interest rates are low, asset level financings were inexpensive. With higher interest rates today, NAV loans are more attractive because they tend to be cheaper than traditional lending alternatives, the collateral is much more diversified than asset level financing, so you tend to get a lower interest rate overall. They have not been widely adopted in venture capital so far and tend to be a little bit more controversial just given the nature of the underlying assets. They tend to be cash flow negative, so they're not generating steady streams of cash flow that can then be used to repay the NAV facility. And they can be controversial for LPs, something that general partners need to be aware of. While use cases include paying down existing debt, facilitating distributions without to limited partners without selling assets, the strategies can cut into the overall returns of the fund and often therefore are not viewed favorably by LPs. And unless they urgently need liquidity, but that's never really a good solution. And so we just see them much more often with buyout funds where the portfolio companies have positive cash flow. They have streams that they can then use to repay the financing down. So there is a reason to use NAV loans, especially if you can get a lower interest rate, but GPs need to be very straightforward, upfront, transparent with LPs. They typically have to get an amendment to the governing documents as well, because most limited partnership agreements don't allow this. So should still consider them in certain situations, but caution GPs that LPs will look at them with scrutiny and expect to have full transparency around them.
The most attractive GP-led secondary transactions are actually happening in the mid-market and lower mid-market segments, contrary to the common belief that large-cap deals are the most valuable, with these small opportunities offering more potential for favorable risk-adjusted returns.
I'm not sure if this is totally counterintuitive, but I think a lot of LPs, when they think about GP-led secondaries, think about large-cap and mega-cap transactions. I will speak for us, those transactions can be really attractive. I mean, you've seen private equity firms selling assets to other private equity firms for years and years. So there's a rationale for that. But at the upper end of the market, they tend to be putting on higher amounts of leverage. Overall, generally, there tends to be less low-hanging fruit when a company is selling for $10 billion. It's already a pretty well-run company. They've already got multiple product lines. Where we're seeing the most activity, but also the most attractive activity, has been at the lower end of the market, which doesn't get talked about as much. I think we'll continue to see deal flow shifting from the large and mega cap continuation transactions to these smaller kind of mid-market, lower mid-market opportunities. There's a lot of scrutiny around continuation vehicles today. A lot of interest in them as well, but I think that will result in more favorable outcomes just given the risk-adjusted return dynamic there.
To navigate continuation funds, LPs should ensure strong GP alignment with significant rollovers and commitments, scrutinize fair economics with realistic fees, and avoid poorly justified or premature transitions.
I mean, number one, absolutely, it's just alignment and the conflicts of interest. So there are a few different things we look at from an alignment standpoint. You know, first, what percentage of the GP's proceeds, which is their commitment and the carry that they received, are they rolling into the CV? You want it to be as close to 100% as possible. If it's less than 70%, you know, I'd be pretty skeptical overall. Are they investing from their latest fund? So many GPs will make a new commitment from their current fund, and that gives you a good sense of what are they actually underwriting to. If they're making the commitment from their new fund, they're ostensibly underwriting to the target returns for that fund. So that should tell you kind of more about how they view the upside of the transaction. And then what is the commitment, the GP commitment to the continuation vehicle? We like to see at least 5%, you know, ideally closer to 10%. On average, we've seen this go up across continuation vehicles, which is a good trend overall. And then also factoring in the size of that, the commitment from the GP. You know, we saw one recently where the GP committed $50 million. And on the surface, $50 million, it looked like a big number overall. But this is a GP that had grown significantly. Their funds are in the billions of dollars overall. Their average equity check is
at least a few hundred million dollars. And so in the grand scheme of things, that was quite small relative to their average ticket. And then related to that, number two, I would say, this is an obvious point, but just what are the economics? The GP is essentially creating a new pool of management fees and carry outside of their prior funds. So ideally, they aren't charging more than 1% on invested capital. Do they have a super carry, which is a carry over 20%? And then importantly, is the carry tiered based on achieving a certain return threshold? You know, we see tiered carries in most of these structures, but you want to pay close attention to them. Some are getting a 15% carry after a low return. You want that to match up with what they're ultimately underwriting the transaction to. And then last, again, probably obvious, but sometimes it gets overlooked, valuation and rationale for the CV. So why is the sponsor pursuing this continuation vehicle? Is it because, you know, if they're 7 or 8 years into the fund life, you're in an environment like today where M&A activity is down, IPO markets are not super attractive, and it's a great asset, then LPs probably do want liquidity. And there's a great reason for them to continue owning that asset and holding it until there's a more favorable exit environment. That makes a ton of sense. We have seen some transactions where the GP has owned an asset for 2 or 3 years and they want to roll it into a continuation vehicle. You know, investors should be very skeptical. Sometimes there's a rationale for it, but they should be very skeptical in those situations. Why should we as investors pay you an additional management fee and carry when you could just keep it into the fund? If you're 2, 3, 4 years into a fund life, there's generally not a great reason to be rolling an asset into a CV.
Liz highlights how the past 5 years defied expectations, from the pandemic's short-lived market dip to the 2021 unicorn surge and an IPO drought that reshaped venture's exit landscape.
Well, I certainly did not see COVID-19, the pandemic, happening. And I, you know, related to that, I would have expected a more prolonged downturn or a more prolonged dip in valuations than we saw. 2021 was one of the craziest environments for venture capital, probably since the dot-com bubble. There was a momentary dip in valuations and a dip in activity in 2020, shortly after the pandemic happened. It was very short-lived, and then valuations just skyrocketed throughout late 2020, throughout 2021, and then first quarter of 2022 until the interest rate hike. Exits were, I mean, it seemed like there was 5 to 10, it was probably more than that, unicorns announced every day with companies going public every day. I did not foresee that exit environment happening. We had been anticipating some market correction, just given how long the run-up in valuations had been since the global financial crisis. I don't think we expected the IPO window to be shut for as long as it has, and for public markets, just general public markets, to be as unaccommodating for venture. But these things are healthy for the markets overall, and I think for venture, we had been in an up market for close to 15 years when interest rates went up. And so I think it did inject some reality, some rationale into the markets overall. But I definitely did not foresee 2020 and 2021 happening overall.
Liz highlights the evolving dynamics of venture capital exits, where traditional public offerings may continue to coexist with newer, more flexible liquidity options, particularly as companies stay private longer and secondary markets become a more prominent part of the landscape.
There's been this trend of companies staying private longer and, you know, in some cases, completely eschewing the public markets. I think that trend will continue, especially with increased regulatory burdens and the fact that some venture-backed companies just are not well-suited for quarterly managing the company to quarterly earnings and the volatility that can happen in stock prices when you, you know, report that you were 1 cent under expectations in a quarter. So I think that trend will certainly continue. Public markets will continue to be, you know, an exit mechanism for category leading companies. I think secondaries have the potential to become more of a mainstay in venture, just simply because they're a
rare source of liquidity and a high risk and long duration asset class. As every market matures, you see more and more secondary activity happening. I think they're particularly well disposed for the venture market, just given the nature of the longer duration and the volatility in that market. And then also for investors, I think they've really embraced secondaries as well, because they allow them to lower the barrier to entry for venture through better access. Top VCs tend to be closed off to new investors. They provide shorter holding periods and discounted pricing in some cases. So they've allowed more investors to gain exposure to venture and to diversify their portfolios. I think that's a healthy dynamic. I think that trend will continue. So in 2030, I would expect to see a lot more secondaries activity in the space. And even once activity normalizes somewhat, you know, secondaries tend to increase in volatile times. And certainly from an exit perspective, when the exit markets are largely muted. But I think even when activity normalizes, the public markets open up a bit more, I think the secondary markets will continue to be fairly robust, given both the capital that's been raised and the fact that LPs have really embraced them. And then overall, I think the last few years have really pushed the traditional VC model to evolve. We've seen it in the recent Sequoia transaction. I think the recent creativity developments in exit alternatives will continue to create more liquidity options than we've ever seen. I think there's real potential for that, for this time period to have real long-lasting impacts on the future of the venture market. So my expectation is that there will be, in 2030, hopefully it will be a more attractive liquidity environment than we have now. But I think that will be fueled by the continued innovation in liquidity alternatives.
The pressure on VCs to generate liquidity quickly, driven by LPs' focus on DPI, has become a tipping point in the current market. While liquidity is important, VCs should avoid selling assets prematurely just to please LPs or raise new funds, as long-term value creation should remain the priority. Successful VCs focus on thoughtful portfolio construction, investing more in winners and less in underperformers to optimize returns.
I do think it's a bit of a tipping point today, because you look at the average hold in VC portfolios, and I think it's 7 or 8 years at this point, which is not crazy. Like, you're an early stage venture investor investing, say, in seed and Series A. You expect to have longer hold periods before you get liquidity. But I do think investors' desire and somewhat, I think, maniacal focus on DPI has been exacerbated by both the amount of capital that was raised and the, you know, heady days of 2021 post-pandemic, but then also the deployment. So a lot of capital was raised. I remember it seemed like a lot of VC funds were coming back to market in some cases after 18 months, but often, like, we expect typical VC private equity funds to come back to market after 3.5, 4 years. It was probably closer to 2 years between 2018, 2019, and 2022. You had some growing investor fatigue from all the rapid fundraisings and the rapid deployment. And then you back that up with limited liquidity. You know, we probably all should have foreseen this happening. That said, VCs should not just generate DPI to generate DPI. Investors in these vehicles should be long-term investors with a long-term mindset that want VCs to maximize the value of their assets and the overall value of the fund. And if there is pressure, I mean, a little pressure to generate liquidity is not a bad thing, but it shouldn't be pressure to generate liquidity just to generate liquidity. I would never want to see a general partner sacrificing a return because they felt like they had to get liquidity back to LPs to then raise their next fund. That's not a healthy dynamic for them or for their investors. So it's a balance there. You know, I think the best venture capitalists are very smart about portfolio construction and managing their loss ratio, which means staging capital over time. You invest in the Series A, but you have, you know, stringent criteria about putting more money into a later, often more highly priced round. the best venture investors tend to invest less money into their underperformers and get more money invested into their outperformers. I think that the stat in VC is that 8 out of every 10 startups fail. But if you're able to limit the capital that you've invested in those failures and maximize the capital invested in the winners, you should outperform. So it's a balance. It's a balance of portfolio construction, taking chips off the table when you have the opportunity, but also not managing the portfolio and exits just so you can come back to market and raise another fund. It's been an interesting development to watch.
Liz Campbell has highlighted that as traditional IPOs are becoming less reliable, understanding how to leverage new liquidity options is crucial for maximizing returns and managing risk. 3 key takeaways emerge from this conversation. The first is that secondary markets and continuation funds have become vital tools for VC firms to access liquidity, providing an essential alternative as traditional exit routes face increasing challenges. The second is that traditional M&A and private equity acquisitions remain the most reliable sources of liquidity in the current market, offering stability amidst the downturn in IPO exits. And the third is that pressure for DPI is reshaping venture dynamics, but VCs must focus on long-term growth and value creation to avoid sacrificing potential returns for short-term liquidity needs. The caveat is that in the current landscape, the definition of a mature VC-backed company has evolved. Today, companies are staying private much longer, and many venture-backed firms are waiting until they achieve more significant growth before seeking liquidity. However, this extended timeline can create pressure to generate returns before companies reach their full potential. In such cases, the push for liquidity, whether through secondary markets or continuation funds, might be premature in this new norm of maturity, as the company could still be in the process of scaling, with its true value still to be realized. This underscores the importance of patience and long-term thinking in assessing when liquidity is truly warranted. If you'd like to learn more about IMD and its courses, go to imd.org. We'll see you next time.